Happy spring! This is the takeaway for Monday, March 20th, 2017.
I never met Putin. I don't know who Putin is.
I may have met him, possibly, what it might have been in Cleveland.
I had no contacts with Russia. I'd never been to Russia. I never spoke to any Russians. I don't know any Russians.
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
I don't know about it. I haven't seen it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. After months of questions over Russia's involvement in the 2016 election and its ties to the Trump campaign, hearings began today on Capitol Hill to try to get some answers, with FBI Director James Comey and NSA Director Mike Rogers called to testify. Here's Comey confirming the FBI is investigating the Trump campaign.
I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts.
And just a little later, Comey said there is no evidence that the previous administration wiretapped then-candidate Trump, as the president has repeatedly claimed.
So no individual in the United States can direct electronic surveillance of anyone. It has to go through an application process, ask a judge. The judge can then make the order.
So President Obama could not unilaterally order a wiretap of anyone?
No president could.
Natalie Andrews is the social media editor and congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She joins me now to explain what the intelligence community actually revealed to the public today. Natalie Andrews, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
Natalie, we heard Comey say that the FBI is actively investigating Russian hacks and any connection to the Trump campaign. What did we learn today about this investigation?
I mean, that's huge news to even have the confirmation that there is an investigation going on, and to have Director Comey on the Hill talking about that in the open and also saying, you know, there could possibly be a connection with the Trump campaign. Even when Jeff Sessions recused himself a few weeks ago, he said, I'm recusing myself, but there may or may not be an investigation. And now we have that confirmation, right? So that's like a big, big things. Even if, you know, James Comey's declining to answer a lot of specific questions that might be asked, these are steps in an investigation.
Steps. Okay, so Comey and Rogers were asked repeatedly about the claims of wiretapping by President Obama. What were they willing to tell the public about them?
I mean, they've been saying repeatedly over and over, you know, that James Comey said a president cannot just unilaterally ask for something to be wiretapped. So, which really goes to Donald Trump's tweet saying, you know, almost accusing President Obama of like a Watergate-like crime to have Trump Tower wiretapped, to have then James Comey say, nope, a president cannot unilaterally have something wiretapped. That's not how it works. I mean, he's just kind of been answering things very procedurally. But even saying those things procedurally really goes against Donald Trump's accusations. And really steps things back and says, look, that couldn't have happened.
Republicans on the committee were less concerned about some of the leaks themselves that have been coming out of these agencies. And it seems more concerned about how these leaks have come to be.
Mm-hmm.
Natalie, is there a genuine culture of leaking throughout the intelligence agencies? And if so, how concerned should we be?
Well, I think I believe it was James Comey who said, in the past few weeks, there certainly seems to be more leaks that have happened. And they said they're looking into that. Mike Rogers almost preemptively answered one of the questions by saying, you know, we only are giving this information to people that are supposed to be seeing it. And they're really keeping that list tight. But there has been some frustration, and when there is frustration, there can be leaking that happens when people don't feel like the organization is running how they want it to be. That's usually when we see leaks or whistleblowing. It's interesting to hear them say there has been more leaks in the past little while, because it certainly seems to be frustrating Donald Trump if you read his Twitter feed.
Right. So where does this go from here? This is just the first of many hearings, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the Senate has scheduled a hearing, so we will see a similar hearing on the Senate side. They're also going to have a classified hearing on the House side. In the classified hearing, they'll be able to ask more questions that we don't hear in public. And eventually, both the Senate and the House committees say they want to have reports that come out that say this is our conclusion on this. But I think we're several months away from getting any sort of conclusion out of that.
Okay, Natalie Andrews is the social media editor and congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
We turn now to Karun Demirjian. She covers national security and foreign policy for The Washington Post and was previously a Moscow correspondent for the paper. Karun is helping us to answer your questions about the Russian hacks and the people in the Trump campaign that we should be focused on. Karun, let's start with this question from our listener.
Hi, this is Mark, an election judge from Lake County, Illinois. What evidence shows that our voting system was hacked? How does it point to Russian actors? And what was hacked, ostensibly, servers or voting terminals? I'd like to know.
All right, Karun, so what does it mean that Russia hacked our election?
Well, it doesn't mean what your caller was asking about. It does not mean that they got into voting machines or manipulated vote totals or were somehow in the county commission or the state board of elections servers and manipulating the way things showed up or who actually had access to the polls. What it was doing, and this is what the former director of national intelligence said earlier this year, that there were Russian efforts to hack various campaign-related organizations. So it's like the Democratic National Committee, Clinton's campaign director, John Podesta. These are all places where there were hacks that were then the information was released through WikiLeaks, but the intelligence community found that the hacks traced back to Russian hacking, and they believe that it was a combination of hacked information and also the dissemination of that information in a way that is designed to serve as propaganda or political influence. It's a hack of various things that go into how we perceive what's going on in the campaign in the whole campaign period.
And Karun, there are a cast of characters involved here who were in Trump's campaign and have various alleged ties to Russia. We will get to Trump, but first let's begin with Michael Flynn, who up until recently was President Trump's national security advisor. He had to resign because he lied to the administration about his contact with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. What do we know about Flynn and Russia?
Well, the episode that you started with, the president said that Michael Flynn did not tell the truth about the substance of his meeting with the Russian ambassador Kislyak to the vice president, and thus he had to ask him to resign. Flynn has prior connections to Russia. There's probably a very famous photo of him sitting at a table with Russian President Vladimir Putin at a dinner for RT. I pause to say the equivalent of Voice of America because it's a lot more intense, I think, and intensely geared. But it's Russian-funded television that's broadcast outside of Russia as well in multiple languages. A lot of it communicates propaganda to the rest of the world. So there's some connections that certainly do precede his tenure in the Trump administration. Going on from there, the other person I feel like we should note at this point, in the same breath as Flynn, just because Flynn did have to resign over these conversations, the other person in the administration that has been shown to have had contacts with Russian officials is Jeff Sessions, who had two meetings with the Russian ambassador as well, which may not have been a big deal had he just disclosed the fact that they happened. But he was asked under oath when he was having his confirmation hearing whether anybody that he knew of in the Trump campaign had had any contacts with Russian officials. And he said no. And he referred to himself saying, you know, some people say I'm a surrogate. And I certainly haven't had talks, but he had just a few months before. And so a lot of the questions about these contacts are just, you know, okay, people talk to the Russian ambassador. That's not a weird thing if you live in Washington, D.C. and you're in politics. But why not tell people about it? Why be secretive about it? That's where it gets weird.
And we know that Trump has had various financial dealings with Russia for decades. What do we know about those connections with Russia?
Well, those aren't as concrete, I believe. He has certainly attempted to start businesses in Russia. There is the episode of the beauty pageant that he owned, trying to get into Russia. So there have been various attempts to do that. The extent to which he has been successful in those business dealings, less so, I think, than in other places where he's made his mark around the world. There are no Trump hotels right now in Russia. There is no major sort of enterprise there. But he's tried to before, and that has left a trail of, you know, connections through. And you probably recall in the last weeks of the election season that there were various reports about, you know, pinging servers back and forth between Trump Tower and Russia's largest private bank. After the election, there was that 35-page dossier that came out alleging that there might be other financial ties, and that dossier had other salacious details in it as well. I should clarify that that dossier came out of information that a British intelligence official gained from Russian sources from within Russia. So there's certainly a lot of speculation. There's certainly a lot of breadcrumbs. It's not clear exactly whether those just are the scattered refuse of business attempts that he tried that did not go that well, or if that actually is a trail that leads to something, as many of his opponents have alleged, that that's, you know, suspicious enough to say there might be actual real collusion connections here.
And also,
which have not been substantiated yet, I should say.
And now, after the election, has there been any potentially illegal contact that we know of so far?
I mean, that's a... I'm pausing just because you've said potentially illegal contact. You really have to parse through what it is that is a suspect and potentially troublesome here, right? Is it, like I said before, is it strange that somebody who is in high-level politics is going to meet with or talk to the Russian ambassador? No. I mean, full disclosure, as a reporter who was heading to Russia, I've talked to the Russian ambassador twice, once right before I went, once right after I came back. That's a normal thing. The question is, what is the substance of those discussions? And did it get to the point where they were saying, don't worry about the sanctions policy, don't deal with the Obama administration, we'll be in office pretty soon, we'll start negotiating, kind of undercutting the sitting administration, which you don't do. Technically, it's illegal. No one's ever been dragged into court under the Logan Act, which is what makes it illegal. But did it go further than that? And also, the reason that everybody is speculating about what is the substance of these conversations and did it get to the point where it's inappropriate or potentially illegal is that we didn't know that it even happened, right? Why not just say, yeah, like as I just said, yeah, I've met the Russian ambassador.
All right. Karun Dimirjian covers national security and foreign policy for The Washington Post, and she was previously a Moscow correspondent for the paper. Karun, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The president was tweeting earlier today about this story, among other things. Before the hearings began, he called the story fake news. And then later during the hearings, he tweeted, quote, the NSA and FBI tell Congress that Russia did not influence electoral process. We should be clear, while Comey and Rogers did say there is no evidence of tampering with voting machines or vote counts, they did say there is reason to believe that Russia did interfere with the presidential campaign. And as we've already reported, the FBI did confirm that they are investigating Russia's involvement and any possible links to the Trump campaign. More on this all week. This is Sarah Gonzalez in for John Hockenberry on The Takeaway. Stay with us. On Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's final day in Asia, North Korea claims to have tested a new type of rocket engine. Another suggestion of a very defiant North Korea in the face of Western calls for calm and stability on the peninsula. On Friday, Tillerson called for an end to Obama's policy called strategic patience. That's where the United States committed to waiting for North Korea to abandon its nuclear program before engaging. Tillerson went on to suggest that the U.S. might even be open to preemptive action against North Korea. Here's the Secretary of State speaking from Seoul late last week.
Let me be very clear. The policy of strategic patience has ended. We're exploring a new range of diplomatic, security, and economic measures. All options are on the table.
To talk about what a change in U.S. policy might mean is Ambassador Christopher Hill. Hill led the U.S. delegation to the six-party talks on North Korea's nuclear program while serving as the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs from 2005 to 2009. Ambassador Hill, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
So in September, North Korea conducted its fifth and most powerful nuclear missile test to date. Are there concerns that these demonstrations of aggression could lead to something more?
Well, there's no question the North Koreans have stepped up their military testing. You know, it's often said that they're testing us. No, they're testing military equipment. They're testing new missile systems, and they're testing nuclear systems. In 2016, they tested two nuclear devices. And at this point, we have to be concerned that they may have a nuclear device that is already designed such that it could go on to the top of a missile. And then they have a deliverable nuclear device. And then we have a big problem.
To what extent is diplomacy possible with North Korea? You were involved in the six-party talks, which are between the United States, North and South Korea, China, Japan, and Russia. What did they hope to achieve and how successful were they?
Well, I think direct diplomacy with North Korea, either through six parties, one-on-one, I think it's looking very difficult because it's pretty clear the North Koreans have no intention of giving up their nuclear weapons right now. So I think the problem is the diplomacy cannot be just focused on North Korea. The diplomacy needs to be focused on other countries in the region, notably China. That is, what can we do to step up sanctions? What can we do to step up pressure? And the one thing we can't do is sort of wait around and wait for a better day. And that's what strategic patience was. And that's what Secretary Tillerson made very clear, that we can't do more of that because this problem is coming down the tracks right at us. And no amount of patience is going to dissuade it.
And so tell us a little bit more about the Obama administration's policy of strategic patience, which you seem to disagree with. What type of relationship did the Trump administration inherit?
Well, the problem with strategic patience, first of all, this is a tough issue, and I'm not blaming the Obama administration for this, but the notion that somehow you can just say, well, we need to be patient, they'll come around. The problem was we weren't really getting anywhere. We didn't have any really new approaches with China. It was sort of to have desultory conversations with them every few weeks to say, hey, you got to do more. And the Chinese say, hey, you got to do more. So nothing was really sort of moving ahead on the China relationship. Although in fairness to the Obama administration, the fact that China recently decided to stop buying North Korean coal, which is a big thing that hurt North Korea, that's an outcome of President Obama's diplomacy. But clearly, we don't have enough, and we certainly don't have the kind of strategic cooperation, if you will, with China, such that they would trust us to kind of work on this problem. And in the event of a North Korean collapse, which could happen if you really put pressure on them, if you stop buying all of their products, if you stop selling any of your products, we would have a situation where North Korea might collapse. And for many Chinese, especially in the Communist Party there, this would look like a defeat for China and a victory for the U.S. And that's one reason they have been very reluctant to talk to us about these things. And I think we need to break through that. And I think the way you do that with the Chinese is you say a minimum on the outside and you say a lot on the inside and a lot of things directly to them so there's no misunderstanding.
And what indication do Rex Tillerson's comments give us about the Trump administration's policy regarding North Korea?
The term that we, that everything's on the table is a kind of typical American term. President Obama used it all the time on Iran. But it's been interpreted to mean that he would look at other possibilities, including the idea of attacking the North Koreans in a preemptive mode. That is, we would see them threatening us, perhaps standing up a missile, and we'd go after that missile and make the first military step. So with that interpretation, and by the way, I think if North Korea stands up a missile, a multi-stage missile that could hit the U.S. and has a nuclear warhead on it, I'm not sure I'd call that preemption. I would call that simply defending yourself. So I think that is what he was suggesting. But I think Secretary Tillerson knows, as many people know, that military approaches, they always sound simple and sound clean. But when you look at South Korea with 20 million people located in the northern part of South Korea within range of North Korean missiles and artillery, they have some 14,000 artillery tubes pointed at the northern part of South Korea, including the capital city of Seoul. You see that military solutions, even ones that are supposed to be quick and clean, such as a missile strike on a North Korean missile base, Those are rather fraught with danger. If one is going to go that route, you have to do it together with the South Koreans. There has to be a great deal of effort to protect that civilian population. It's quite an undertaking. So no one should think there's some easy option out there that we simply haven't been able to look at. And I think it's pretty clear that President Trump said a few weeks ago that, gee, he never thought healthcare was this complicated. Well, wait till he gets a load of the North Korean nuclear problem.
All right. Ambassador Christopher Hill is Dean of the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver and author of Outpost, Life on the Front Lines of American Diplomacy, a Memoir. Ambassador Hill, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thanks so much for listening. The confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice nominee Neil Gorsuch begin today. Gorsuch won't answer questions until tomorrow, but even when he is questioned, don't expect to learn anything illuminating about his positions. For decades, Supreme Court nominees have given vague, evasive, non-answers during their confirmation hearings. Ever wondered why? A new video from our friends at Retro Report argues it all goes back to one man, Robert Bork. Barbara Dury is a producer for Retro Report, and she joins me now. Barbara, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So in 1987, Ronald Reagan nominated Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. Who was Bork and what happened during his confirmation hearings?
Well, Robert Bork had been a federal judge. He had been the Solicitor General in the United States during Watergate. He was extremely conservative. He had been a Yale law professor, and he had written many controversial documents over the years from the 60s on. So his life was an open book, really, his opinions about certain issues. So he knew going into the hearings that that would all be brought up.
Senator Ted Kennedy came out particularly strong against Bork. Take a listen.
In Robert Bork's America, there is no room at the inn for blacks and no place in the Constitution for women. And in our America, there should be no seat on the Supreme Court for Robert Bork.
Well, Ted Kennedy did come out very tough on him, and he took all of his positions to an extreme logical conclusion. Robert Bork was claiming that he had really changed his positions over the years, and that really became the center of the hearings. That was at the heart of it.
And former Senator John Danforth, a Republican from Missouri, defended Bork during these hearings. Here he is looking back.
Robert Bork was the beginning of the politicization of the Supreme Court. This is political. We got to win the battle. And if it takes destroying this decent human being to win the battle, so be it.
Now, especially after the Senate refused to hold hearings for President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland, it seems like a given that these nominations will be a political battle. Your video pinpoints Robert Bork as the beginning of the politicization of the Supreme Court.
Well, it did certainly set it up for that because Robert Bork, when he started talking, now this was on live for 5 days, he was on at the hearings, and the American people really got to see and hear him and what his positions were. Polling at the time certainly showed that the American people were not in favor of him.
How did his responses during these hearings change the future of Supreme Court nomination hearings?
Well, it taught future nominees not to say too much, to be very vague, because he was very open. It was a very open discussion. It's what you traditionally would want to hear from a Supreme Court nominee. So it taught future nominees, like, don't say too much because you're not going to get this cherished position that you've maybe worked your whole life for.
At the time, Bork ultimately was voted against, and Anthony Kennedy eventually got the spot on the bench. And his views, I think, at the time were a little more in line with what the American people wanted. Would you agree with that?
I do agree. What happens is, you know, the president nominates these people, but the Senate has as much power as the president of who should go on the Supreme Court. It's their job to advise and consent. And that's what they did with Robert Bork. So many may feel he was Borked and it was unfair, and we have people talking about that. But at the end of the day, it was a very good vetting, and the American people really got to see and hear what Judge Bork's views were and whether they wanted someone like him on the Supreme Court.
Barbara Dury is a producer for Retro Report. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
You can watch Retro Report's video on thetakeaway.org. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for joining us. Flexibility has been a touchstone for community colleges across the country. They offer early morning classes, late night lectures, online courses, all as part of an effort to reach more people who can't make a traditional class schedule work. And it's good for business, too. Adding class on Saturdays and Sundays seems like the logical next step. That's the concept behind a new initiative at a handful of schools around the country. This semester, Miami-Dade College in South Florida launched its weekend college program. WLRN's Rowan Moore Garrity was there for a tour and to talk to students.
Yomaira Hidalgo used to take college classes three nights a week. In a word, she says, it was
miserable. I mean, attending to your partner and the baby and trying to do homework, and it wasn't happening.
Her homework would just pile up all week long. Hidalgo is a mother of three who works full-time at a pharmacy and starts out each morning driving her mother and her son to where they need to be.
To get him up, like, hey, come on, take a shower. Then he takes 40 minutes in the shower. It's like, you don't have that much body. Can you please?
Hidalgo is working towards an associate's degree so she can become a crime scene investigator. But with weekdays that start early and end late, she says,
it makes sense for me to go do it on the weekends because it makes my schedule a little easier.
3/4 of our student population have the same issues.
Efrain Venezuela is an associate dean who helps to oversee Miami-Dade's weekend college program.
They have two jobs, they have relatives to take care of, both parents are working, they have children, they have financially challenged at this point. They want something, they want to finish a degree. But unfortunately, they have the personal situations that preclude them from even to be a regular, whatever you call regular, you know, daytime student. They have to be evening and weekends.
Venezuela says administrators noticed lots of students getting tripped up with weekday obligations. Students who might want to consolidate all their classes into 1 or 2 days on campus or get here without fighting Miami's notorious rush hour traffic.
When you offer them the opportunity to say, listen, you know, don't quit. You can finish up your only weekends. You go, like, okay, that sounds cool.
Certainly, community colleges have fundamentally tried to organize themselves to be convenient.
Tom Bailey directs the Community College Research Center at Columbia University. What's new about Weekend College at Miami-Dade is that financial aid, academic advising, and tutoring are all available on Saturdays, too. Bailey says that's crucial to helping weekend students succeed. And he says it hints at one reason we're starting to see similar programs sprout at community colleges nationwide.
The longer it takes for a student to finish, the less likely they are to finish.
So how do you get busy people to enroll full time or keep the students you already have from dropping out?
If you have weekend college, you can keep your full time job.
And that brings us to the second reason, which might be even more important. Community colleges nationwide saw a boom in enrollment during the recession, when full-time work was harder to come by. Now they're coping with a drop in new students as the labor market tightens. Weekend college is one possible solution to the squeeze.
So it does take discipline to come to school on a weekend. It does take a drive.
Raul Corzo's finance class starts promptly at 8 a.m. on Saturdays. There are currently 2,100 students enrolled in weekend courses at this campus. Not all of them are full-time, but there are plans to expand the course offerings semester by semester. For the time being, students can earn a variety of associate's degrees or a bachelor's in business administration.
All right, guys. Working in both formulas. Give me the results.
There's more than one budding business owner in this class.
In order for me to be in business, I want to make 10.75. If not, I'm not in business.
Student Ashley Jitta works in HR for the county government and runs a fleet of mobile car washes on the side. That makes it impossible to think about college during the week, even if she would rather spend Saturdays taking her kids to the beach.
It kind of is like bittersweet because I'm doing this for my children so that I can grow in my career, better my business, and just be a role model to them. But being away from them on the only day that we both have off.
Another weekend student, Sergio Espino, says he waited decades after getting his associate's degree to come back for a BA. It was just too hard to juggle school and work while he was raising a family. He says weekend college has finally given him the opportunity.
You really want to know? It's been 40 years since I got my AS degree here, and I'm back to finish.
For The Takeaway, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity in Miami.
To keep up with all our reporting on America's new credentials, please visit thetakeaway.org/credentials. Earlier this year, a woman named Irvin Gonzalez went to the police to report that her ex-boyfriend had punched, kicked, and strangled her, and at least once chased her with a knife. Gonzalez, a victim of domestic abuse, was hoping to seek a protective order against him from a local courthouse. But when she got there, she was detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and she was indicted on charges of illegal entry. This is a major fear for immigration advocates who have been cautioning undocumented immigrants to keep a low profile and to avoid encounters with law enforcement. But then what happens when an immigrant has to report a crime? There's a real concern that victims, especially women, will be reluctant to report sexual assault or domestic abuse to authorities. It's an issue Jasmine Garst is covering for PRIs Across Women's Lives. Jasmine Garst, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jasmine, you spoke to a woman who goes by the name of Nazdeya. Tell us what is her story.
Sure. Nazdeya came on a student visa. She's from Eastern Europe. Let's hear about that.
I like it here. Back home, I had a dream to become a lawyer, but the life is so corrupted if you don't know anyone or you're not from the capital, you cannot really pursue your dream. You cannot get what you want. And here I saw that if you work hard, if you have a goal, you will succeed.
Nadzeya is not her real name. She asked for protection. And she overstayed her visa and became undocumented. And she became involved with a man who is an American citizen. And like many abusive relationships, it started out wonderfully. They had a kid, and it escalated to this level of really horrific violence. I should also mention that one thing Nadzeya talked to me about is, you know, just to be politically incorrect, mm-hmm. when you see Nadzeya, you don't necessarily think this is the face of undocumented immigration. She is an Eastern European woman, very pale, you know, platinum blonde hair. And she told me, like, nobody at work thought this is an undocumented woman who is being beaten.
Right. So, Jasmine, let's hear why she didn't go to the police.
I was afraid to go to police. Because he told me that if you go to the police, I have something, I will tell them something that you're going to end up losing your child and they will deport you. So, police was totally not an option for me.
So who is it that's giving her this advice?
He is. So this is a classic scenario with undocumented immigrant women who are in these positions of no power at all.
Are there services in place to help women like Nazdeya?
Absolutely. I mean, what Nazdeya ended up doing is she went to a shelter. She did not call the police. One day the violence got completely... There was an incident in which it got unbearable, so she bursts out of her house with a backpack, a stroller, and the baby. And once she gets to the shelter, someone starts talking to her about some legal options. I spoke to someone from a Sanctuary for Families here in New York. It's an organization that precisely helps families and women and survivors of domestic violence. I spoke to Carmen Ray, and she told me Nadzeya's story did not surprise her at all.
The classic story for us is generally a woman who has survived domestic violence for decades, and finally there's an incident of such extreme violence that she's forced to call the police for her own safety.
I know that there are special visas that can help some undocumented immigrants who are victims of crimes, including domestic abuse. Can you tell us about some of those visas?
Sure. The U visa essentially allows undocumented immigrants who need to report a crime to come forward, and they can expect protection. There's about 10,000 that are given a year, and there's an enormous wait list. And Nadzeya herself, she had to wait over a year to get this, which, think about that. It means for a year, she was still living in a very precarious situation. She did eventually get her U visa, and here's how she reacted to that.
I started screaming like crazy. I was crying. Like, I couldn't believe it. For me, the whole date, just the ideas start changing one another. What can I do right now? How my life can change right now? What the next step for me?
Do we know if there's any plan to change the ability to apply for a U visa under the Trump administration?
The administration has not discussed U visas yet. What is a concern for activists and people who work in domestic violence prevention, immigrant protection, is the environment we're living in, right? It's not just about someone like Natseya saying, well, if I call the police, maybe I'm going to get deported. It's also, it puts families in these really awkward situations. I mean, for example, imagine you're a kid and you see one of your undocumented parents beating your other undocumented parent up. Are you going to call the police and risk that one of your parents, or maybe both of them, are going to be deported? It just creates a sentiment of a lot of distrust. And Carmen Ray from Sanctuary for Families was saying to me, it's really making her job a bit more difficult.
People are very concerned in the community that if they are the victims of a crime, that reporting it is going to cause retaliation against them by the perpetrator. But people are also very concerned, especially with crimes that result in a family environment, that by calling authorities on the person that's hurting them, they're potentially causing their deportation.
Jasmine, is Natseya out of the shelter?
She is. She's out of the shelter, and she has a really good job. You know, she's still hurt. She has this thing where she just winces a lot, and she starts wincing more when she talks about this. But she's doing very well. She lives for her kids. She was able to get an actual, real, official job, which means she can have health care, which means she can have health care for her children, which means she can put her kids in a good school, which means she can get an apartment. But fundamentally, what it means is she's not scared anymore, and she is not in a position of complete powerlessness. If something happens, Natseya calls the police.
All right. Jasmine Garce is a reporter for PRI's Across Women's Lives. Jasmine, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Sarah Gonzalez, in for John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway. Our ongoing series, Uncomfortable Truths, takes us to Minneapolis this week to explore identity. Annie Anderson, the engagement and inclusion manager at Minnesota Public Radio News, sat down with her close friend, Tommy Beavis. He's a restaurant entrepreneur in the city, and he moved to the States from Jamaica at age 19. Their families have been more than just neighbors for the greater part of a decade. Tommy is the godfather to Annie and her partner's two children, and Annie says Tommy and his wife's baby daughter feels like a third kid. While they talk regularly about the role of race in their family and in their community, their conversation about identity was trickier to navigate. So Annie asked Tommy to write down the strongest words he would use to identify himself. His first two were Jamaican and Christian. When Annie revealed a few of her choices, white wasn't one of them. And Tommy was a bit surprised by her list.
First, I'm a woman. And second, I would say that I'm queer.
Wow. And you identify as queer.
That also depends on where I am or who I'm with.
Wow. Okay. Help us understand that.
You've probably heard me identify differently depending on where I am and who I'm with.
But when you're there with your partner, your lovely partner, Bridget, describe the discomfort and help me understand, like, when you showed up and you're like, okay, now I'm going to have to be queer in an uncomfortable situation.
Yeah. So we have the luxury of having the choice to show up as queer or not, because it's not something you can see when you look at us, right? So differently than, like, when you and your wife, Dara, show up somewhere, you're black. Mm-hmm. You don't get to not be black when you go somewhere. We can not be openly gay if we choose to. We very rarely choose that. But, I mean, I'm aware of my surroundings. Aren't you aware of your surroundings?
Always. But I think specifically what I was trying to understand is what comes up for you when you enter a room wearing your queer hat because your queer partner's there with you. What comes up for you internally? I recall one time we were at brunch with friends and we're there sitting down, and this is, I think it was your first time meeting the new partner. Second time meeting this new partner of our very good mutual friend.
Mm-hmm.
We then proceed to have wonderful conversations, mm-hmm. and then we stumble upon the queer conversation.
Yeah.
And that was my first time experiencing you experiencing something so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was uncomfortable. I mean, he was very clearly uncomfortable with us. And he's supposed to be family because he's our friend's now husband. And I have to keep myself in check in those situations because his wife means so much to me.
But how did you feel when you recognized the issues?
Mostly disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since you don't want your friends to be with people who don't accept the rest of the people in their lives. So, Jamaican, Christian, give me one more.
Black.
When did you know you were black?
I've always known I was black, interestingly enough. But one of the first times it popped out to me was at the University of West Indies, Kingston. I was attacked on campus, got cut, a major scar across my face, which I still bear today. My family then got the police involved, and we're at the police station. And the person who cut me was, interestingly enough, mixed. And my father, in such rage, when the person who cut me, mother, was trying to reach out to him and touch him, he's like, "Don't you dare touch my beautiful black skin." I was like, "Gulp, what?" Oh. He was very angry. He was very hurt. And at the same token, I'm like, yeah, that dude ruined my beautiful black skin. Because no matter where I go, one of the first things people will notice is a massive scar, which in Jamaica we call telephone cut, across my cheek.
How long have we known each other? 8, 9 years?
Uh-huh.
I've never heard that story.
Yeah. That's one of the first times I realized my blackness and realized that it was scarred.
How old were you?
17.
When did you move to the States?
2 years later. Right after that, my family shipped me out.
But would you ever identify as African-American?
I wouldn't for two reasons. One, because the African-American experience is very different than my own. Albeit we were all slaves, but slavery in America and Jim Crow in America and being black in America has been very different than an experience that I've had. And then I think the other reason is because I think that if I identify as African-American, I automatically lose my Jamaican identity. And so it's always interesting when I see forms and they have African-American. I sometimes, if I'm trying to be smart, I would choose the other and then write in black or something like that. But that was back when I was a kid. But now I just check whatever box is available because you're trying to get through the form.
Ah, the form.
Yeah, the form for you, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, they just ask, I'm white.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not one of the identities I listed when I wrote mine down.
Huh. Yeah, what is your third identity? You never mentioned yours.
I wrote mother.
Mother, wow.
Yeah, so checking the boxes on the race ethnicity question on forms is I check white. Sometimes I want to be snarky and check other too because history. But that's easy. And yeah, I didn't write white down and I think that just shows that that's the default.
And also because you probably don't think of white as your identity because you don't need to think of white as your identity.
Exactly.
Because it's the default.
Exactly. I think of these other things as my identity.
Mm-hmm. Because that's what sets you apart is how you see it.
Right. If I look in the mirror, I don't see my whiteness. I see my womanness.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, being white in America, not a lot of baggage necessarily. Tell me about daily life in Minneapolis as a black man. When and where does that matter? How does it show up?
You know what's so interesting? As amazing as our neighborhood is, where you have people getting their hair locked or cut right down the street from us, this has always been a subconscious fear I've had. Taking out the trash after dark to go in the alley. My biggest fear isn't, the thug who's trying to break into a house next door is going to see me and try to kill me or rob me. It is a neighbor who sees me, doesn't recognize me, and decided to take action. And I have amazing neighbors. You're
right.
One of them.
Right. I mean, I was like, we know our neighbors.
Right.
By name.
I started a business with a neighbor.
Right.
And I swear it's not because of the Black Lives Matter movement or anything like that. It's been...
It's just how you exist in this world.
Yeah.
I don't have that fear when I take out the trash late at night.
What do you think that fear would feel like for you?
I don't think I can answer that because I've never pervasively felt threatened by my very existence of who I am. I have felt unsafe at various times, usually because I'm a woman, not because I'm gay. But I don't walk out my door in the morning wondering if something's going to happen to me just because of the way I look.
Right. And so many of us wish we could know what that was like. So many of us wish when we're sending our partners off to work, we didn't have to wonder, didn't have to imagine, wouldn't have to envision the talking points in your head that you're going to have to go out there and say, no, my partner is not one of them.
I don't even know what that means. Right. Like,
right. But you have to remember the them is that same guy, Tommy Beavis, in a hoodie, taking out his trash after hours.
I know.
Naturally, I'm a thug.
Naturally. You're like one of the most successful people I know. And kindest to
oh,
boot.
Thank you.
Yeah, I remember after Philando Castile was shot here, we were listening to the radio in my car with my kids, as we do. And my daughter started asking a bunch of questions, like, why? And I was trying to explain it, and it's really hard to explain to a four-year-old. But we're real honest with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, she asked who shot him, and I told her. And she asked why, and I didn't know. And I said, sometimes this happens. And she says, well, to who? I said, it happens often to black men. She said, like Uncle Tommy. And I said, yeah, like Uncle Tommy. And she looked at me and she goes, but I don't want Uncle Tommy to get shot.
Right.
And I remember thinking, A, it was like a punch to the gut. And I was like, that's a heavy weight that I just put on my kid to be scared that one of her most beloved people in her life could be irrationally injured for just being who he is. And then I stepped back and thought, that heavy weight that just got put on my white kid is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the daily that you live, or, you know, your siblings live, just all the people in our life.
Imagine my wife, Dara, having to explain that to our daughter, Genesis, that, oh, your father could be one of those, or you could be one of those. One thing I would say, though, is people should not be afraid. And I'd say this to the grandmothers who clutch their purses in the elevator. You are missing out on so much simply by choosing to remain in your bubble. Step away for a second. Even that same thug who you think you're afraid of, just by simply saying hi to that person, you realize how quickly they are a very different person than you perceived. You recognize how quickly, how warm they are as a normal human being. You recognize how very quickly how funny they can be. You can learn their story in one elevator ride, and that can change your day, if not your life. And that's simply by being bold and unafraid to meet and connect with other.
Mm-hmm. But in America, at least now, you're used to being the only black person in a room.
Mm-hmm.
In corporate America, in meetings, in restaurants, in Target. For a lot of most, I would guess, white Minnesotans, they have never been the only white person anywhere ever in their lives.
Right.
And that's a space. I have been the only white person in your backyard.
True.
But there are so many people who don't open themselves up to themselves being different, because then you have to go into spaces where you make mistakes, your assumptions get challenged, and you get put in positions to where you have to maybe defend yourself or your ideas or who you are. And that's not something most of the white people I know are very good at.
Mm-hmm. You have to recognize that you're in a melting pot, a microcosm of the world, where you have so many opportunities to explore other. It's your choice. It's up to you if you want to remain in your bubble. Seriously. Because there's so much to learn and enjoy and embrace and aspire and just love. Just love. And that's the definition of one love right there.
Aww.
You know? And this is America, and the beauty of America is the ability and the opportunity to be exposed to so much other and embrace other. Even when they're different than you, you welcome the other, because it's an opportunity for all of us to learn, grow, and thrive.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
Annie Anderson is the Engagement and Inclusion Manager at Minnesota Public Radio News. She talked with her friend Tommy Beavis, a restaurant entrepreneur in Minneapolis. We want to hear from you, and we want you to participate. Visit thetakeaway.org/truths. Tell us who you'd like to have a difficult conversation about race with, whether it's a friend or a family member or a coworker. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, in for John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.